the entire history. But you can see during that 10-year period, there have been a couple of occasions where we've exceeded $1 billion in the capital program for the year, but 2014 did modestly exceed the highest previous year. So in summary, revenue is $14 million greater, maintenance and operations spending $1 million less than the revised budget. The debt service transfers were right in line with what we had estimated in October. And capital program spending was the highest in the tollway's history. I do have a couple of other items that we have distributed. I think you have the full report. It's 30 pages. If you want more specifics and details about the variances, that's in the quarterly financial report. We've also distributed a report that Kathy prepares with respect to quarterly investments. It's quarterly investment activity summary. We encourage you to take a look at that and call myself or Kathy, and we will answer any questions that you might have.
Or answer any questions now if you're so
inclined. We also, I wanted to let you know that, seems like it changes every week, but the market has been favorable the last week to 10 days. We are actually starting to gear up with our refunding transaction of the 2008 B bonds, and we will keep you apprised. Our goal would be to try to price that transaction in mid to late April. Okay. All right. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank Mike to you and your team. Do an excellent job for us on budgeting and finance, and also making sure that we can pay for the program that we've launched. So that's all good. Those are all good things.
Mike, in the sale of the bonds and where you cut, how negatively would that be looked at the way in our scheduled construction? Or would it?
It is a question that arises. It's an issue I think that they would look at. It's typically not it's not an issue that concerns the investors a great deal unless there is a significant delay. Delays of a short duration is something that that can be accommodated within the plan. If it's longer or projects are shut down for an extended period, that is something that they would have concern about. I think probably more from the potential to disrupt traffic if you have an incomplete project than the fact that project wasn't done.
I think when we went out to talk to some of the potential buyers and the rating agencies at the time that the Move Illinois program was being unveiled, what they looked at was the record of the tollway, wouldn't you say, and the capacity to be able to complete construction. I'm sure some kind of slowness at one point or another might draw their attention, but my recollection is they really were looking at the history of how the tollway had done in construction.
Historically, I don't think there's ever really been done. Right.
Yeah. And I think that's what they were looking at when they reviewed our capacity.
Great. Thank you again. Thank you. Before we get into discussion, speed limits, probably a good time to remind everyone, if you weren't aware, that it is Work Zone Safety Awareness Week. I know Mike Stone participated in a press conference with IDOT and I think the state police, maybe others, about the importance of being mindful. The joke goes that there are two seasons, probably in the whole Midwest, but certainly in Illinois, and one of them is construction, and we're coming up on that season now. So to keep everyone safe, we just remind people to really pay attention on those work zones and pay attention to the posted speed limits, regardless of whether workers are present, right? Right, correct, okay. And expect the unexpected. Now I'd like to introduce John Benda, our General Manager of Maintenance and Traffic, and Jeff Hockmuth from CDM Smith, who are going to review our work on speed limits, talk a little bit about the commitment to safety and speed limit recommendations and next steps. We did review this at the Customer Service Committee earlier this month, but obviously we think it's an important enough topic that we wanted to also brief the board in the entire presentation. So, John, please go ahead.
Chair Wolf, directors, thank you for the opportunity to get up here this morning and talk about speed limits. Our agenda, we'll talk a little bit about safety, speed limit background, recent developments, legislation that has given the agency the opportunity to increase the limits, MIDOT's new methodology. I'll be assisted by Jeff Hockmuth from CDM Smith, who will talk and walk the board through the methodology that was used and answer any technical questions. And then we'll go through our recommended speed limit increases and the next steps. So, safety is really the bottom line in everything that we do in engineering and in maintenance. And it's important to know that we have an obligation, professional engineers have an obligation, to set speed limits as safest for motorists as part of their professional engineering code of ethics. And that relates both to internal tollway staff and to our traffic consultant, CDM Smith. Tollway's initiatives in recent years, the Congestion Relief Program in Move, Illinois, are intended to foster safe roadways for customers and reduce crashes. When we completed portions of the Congestion Relief Program, we went back and took a look at what the impact of that was on our safety record and our traffic. And we noted reductions in crashes, 11% due to adding additional capacity over segments of the system, 12% reduction from open road tolling. You no longer had to stop and the queue going into a plaza or out of a plaza, the merge, so that was a tremendous benefit. And thirdly, our integrated operational approach to how we manage traffic and how we manage incidents on our system resulted in a 12% reduction. So overall, there's a 35% reduction in crashes in the system. Okay, the tollway has a proven track record for quick incident response and clearance. Our current secondary crash rate is under 4%. Our total response and clearance time on average for all crashes is at 30 minutes, which is, I'll put those numbers up against anybody in the country in terms of how they deal with incidents on their interstate highway. Long term, our commitment continues to safety. The Move Illinois program contains elements to increase capacity, obviously the I-90 corridor, and other improvements, moving toward all electronic tolling on new highways, and implementing active traffic management, which we've heard about on the east end of I-90. Before I talk about speed limits, I wanted to brief the board on this committee. There's a cross-discipline committee in the authority that's actually been in operation since 2000 that monthly meets and reviews system performance, safety, crashes, and other information so that we have a pulse on what's going on in our system on a monthly basis. And state police is a critical element of this operation, as well as, you'll note, several of the operating departments and operations at the tollway. This committee is supported by both our traffic engineer, CDM Smith, and our general engineering consultant, ACOM. They review a wide range of things, and the speed, the crash reduction numbers that I mentioned earlier were actually a study that was commissioned by this committee as we got through major portions of the congestion relief program. So we're always tuned into safety and looking to see how the system's performing. By way of background on the speed limits, it was this committee in 2010 that recommended that we start to review and study speed limits, perform speed limit studies on segments of the system that had been completed and widened with additional capacity under the congestion relief program. Armed with the crash reduction data, the committee thought it would be appropriate to start reviewing speed limits. In that same time frame, so we actually began the speed limit studies in 2011. A couple of changes in Illinois law have occurred since that time that allowed speed limits to be raised to 70 outside of the urban districts. And then a second change that allowed, or actually takes the tollway out of the urban district definition, which gives us flexibility to increase truck and bus speeds in the urban area. The tollway did raise the speed limits for trucks and buses, for cars, beginning in January 2014 on I-90 west of the I-39 interchange, or the north-south orientation, if you will, from Cherry Valley through the Rockford region up toward Wisconsin, and on the west end of I-88, west of Route 47. We then also raised the speed limits for buses and trucks in those same areas, although on I-88 we were bound to make the change west of King County. So right now we have 70 miles an hour on the west end of I-88 and on the north or west end of I-90. Okay, other developments that occurred in this time frame. In 2014, IDOT published a new policy on establishing and posting speed limits in the state highway system in Illinois, and for the first time provided specific methodology on how to set speed limits on interstate highways. The prior IDOT policy, which we were aware of and have used previously, really focused generically on all roads, but this policy provided some direct guidance for interstates. Traffic Operations Safety Committee, again, in light of this change, directed CDM Smith to go back and review all of our previous studies and the studies moving forward under the IDOT methodology. There was no reason to go back and review the rural areas where we had already made speed limit changes, at least not as far as the speed limit study, so those were left unchecked. The study starts with the 85th percentile, and Jeff, if you want to come up, and I'll start through this, and then you can take over when we get to the graph. You start with the 85th percentile. You heard that earlier. That's the speed under which 85% of the traffic is traveling at or below. It's taken under optimal conditions, generally in the central part of a segment that's under study, under free flow conditions outside of the rush hour or noon. It's during daylight hours, weather conditions are clear, pavement is dry. To ensure optimal measurement, it's obtained discreetly, so we don't have vehicles overtly out there with LIDAR radar units. We don't use squad cars. We do this from a hidden location. There are 100 readings that are taken per lane to ensure the sample represents all traffic, and spot speeds are typically measured in the center of the segment. I think I mentioned that earlier. To graphically show this beginning of the process is this chart, and I would like Jeff Hockmuth to take over from here.
Thank you, John. As John mentioned, we go out there and unobtrusively try and get real speeds from traffic out there. What you see here on this graph is one particular location that represents 800 data points, 100 speed readings per lane across both directions. You'll see where the 85th percentile line is on the right, and that is something that the 85th percentile concept number is embraced by, I believe, every single agency in using speed limits, including IDOT. Also there you'll see the 10-mile-per-hour pace. That's the block in the middle. What it represents is the 10-mile-per-hour range that contains the highest number of readings. Per the IDOT formula, which I'll get into, we use the top of the 10-mile-per-hour pace included in the prevailing speed. Also, you'll see the average is somewhere in the middle. Just want to point out that when you take a look at the 85th percentile, there's a large majority of the traffic that's going slower than the 85th percentile, and especially on interstates, sometimes 5 to 10 miles per hour slower than the 85th percentile. When we were first tasked as a tollways traffic engineer taking a look at speed limits, we knew we had to address the IDOT methodology. We knew we had to get IDOT approval. So we started with that. But we also took a look at what federal government would recommend, what other states were doing, to try and see if there were ways that we can improve upon, enhance what IDOT did, provide something even better. What we found, this study started around 2011. The latest IDOT methodology we really believe is superior to anything else. And as John mentioned, where we have seen policies or procedures written down by states, it's a blanket procedure that applies to your local street as much as it applies to an interstate. That's we know the character of the road, the character of the traffic is vastly different on those. So it makes sense that you want to have a different procedure or you consider different factors. Every single state we saw basically follows the top three bullets there. You start with a prevailing speed. Some of them use 85th percentile straight. Many, like IDOT, use a combination of the 85th percentile, the 10 mile per hour pace, and information from average speed runs. You start with a prevailing speed. You make adjustments according to crash history or other issues that you might be a concern on the road. And in the end, there's some engineering judgment that's involved. The IDOT methodology, where it really is superior, is they identified different crash rates in those adjustments. Let me just address congestion as one of those. As somebody who spends a large majority of my time dealing with crashes and crash data on the tollway system, by far the majority of the crashes on the tollway system are in the peak periods or on the shoulders of the peak periods where there's congestion. It is a large factor in terms of safety on the system. It is something that we need to consider. That said, the IDOT methodology for the congestion is if you exceed that congestion threshold, it's a 2.5% adjustment. It is not a large adjustment on the prevailing speed. So we take a look at the IDOT factors. Yes?
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just referring to Mr. Donner's comment, he was talking about how dangerous it was to have people go at the posted speed limit and other people going more quickly. When you did your crash analysis, I gather what you're saying is that wasn't necessarily the conclusion that you reached. And maybe you can't answer this right off the top.
You can say individually, a large differential in speeds is a dangerous situation. And you'll see that, and that's part, again, reflected here. When you have traffic stopped in the right lane and flowing at 70 in the left lane, people make maneuvers, people change lanes, and that's a dangerous situation. What I'm saying is the vast majority of the problems, the safety issues on the tollway, are related to congestion,
not to
somebody driving 55.
Got it. Okay, thank you. They may be driving 55 because there's congestion in their lane, and then they try to pull out into the 70-mile-an-hour lane.
Correct.
Not that somebody's going at the posted speed limit.
That's not the majority of the problem.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
So all these adjustments that IDOT identified in their new methodology, we've applied them as they were applicable. The engineering analysis then, we take a look at some things like consistency. That's really determining logical breakpoints. An example, where we're when we looked at a segment from O'Hare to Lake Cook Road, and the speed limit's actually being recommended to be increased there. Well, there's a lot of congestion and a lot of accident history southbound approach in the O'Hare area, so our recommendation was to bump the speed limit up north of 2E Avenue to provide a slower speed limit where the congestion and the crash rate's the worst. So consistency, logical checkpoints, design speed, we've discussed previously, and if you have questions, maybe Paul or John are better to represent that or address that. But the real advantage of the new IDOT methodology is that, as I mentioned, some states embrace 85th percentile and use that a lot. Some states embrace engineering analysis and engineering judgment and use that a lot. The IDOT methodology really quantifies a lot of what was previously an engineering judgment and puts numbers on it, and I think that really makes it superior to what most other states are doing right now. I'm going to turn back to John, unless there's any questions.
You can stay up. Okay, so prior to 2014, there had been no changes in speed limits for some time. We increased speed limit locations. I mentioned earlier the first two in rural areas, those west of Route 47 for cars on I-88 and north of the I-39 interchange, ultimately for both cars and trucks. Overall speed limit changes that we're recommending as part of our recommendation today will encompass major portions of the system as shown in green. Now again, we've already adjusted the rural areas, but we're looking at adjusting 88 from its terminus with the Eisenhower out to Aurora, from the current 55 to 60, and then from Route 31 in Aurora, increasing it to 65 out to where it goes up to 70 west of 47. 355 would increase from 55 to 60 miles per hour on the core of 355 from Army Trail on the north to I-55 on the south. I-55 remains at 55 miles an hour in that area. And we previously did increase the south extension of 355 to 65. We're not recommending any changes to that because that would be consistent with how 80 is posted. 80 is currently posted at 65. So it makes sense to keep the speed limit on 355 the same as the southern terminus system interchange. Two adjustments on the tri-state from Route 57. New interchange on the south end of that, up to I-55. We're recommending an adjustment from 55 to 60. And north of the airport, again, it's actually 2 Avenue, north to Deerfield Road, adjusting it to from 55 to 60, and then north of Deerfield 65 to connect with the existing 65-mile-hour segment up there. This is just a detail that a little tough to read from there to walk through, and I think I've just walked through the actual adjustments, so there's no need to go through that. In the locations where in the urban area where cars go to 60, trucks will also be able to go to 60. That's, again, because Illinois Tollway was excluded from the definition of urban district in one of the legislative changes. So cars and trucks will, for the most part in the system, be traveling the same speed. Or we'll have at least the same maximum speed limit. You will note that I-90, one comment about that, we have to have some operating data. While we've completed the western portion of I-90 from Randall Road out to the Route 39 interchange at Cherry Valley, we do not have enough operating data. We anticipate conducting that data collection in September of this year, and then we'll actually formulate a speed limit study and a recommendation for an adjustment to that if it's warranted. Right now, that segment is reposted at 65, which is the speed limit that rural segment was posted at prior to construction. And then the black area here is the segment from Randall Road into the airport, which is currently under construction, will be under construction for a couple years. So we won't see any recommendations regarding speed limits on that until after we get some operating data after that improvement is completed. With that, I'll entertain any questions you might have. Or, Paul, have I forgotten something?
On the one of the questions that I had was related to design speed, engineered design speed. When Mr. Donner,
he left.
I think he said, or there was a comment made that isn't included in the IDOT policy. Is that correct? Is that a different? Is that something that?
No, it is specifically in IDOT's policy.
It is.
IDOT's policy recommends against setting speeds above the design speed of the segment of highway.
Okay, and if you would.
And this slide actually shows what the current design speeds are for our system.
And can you just give a little detail about what goes into what is contemplated as far as design speeds?
When you're planning a road, you identify what the design speed is for the road. That then determines the engineering design and consideration that goes into it. So if you say that your road is going to be designed for 60 miles an hour, that then translates into engineering criteria on the types of curves, the severity of curves, the vertical alignment of the road, so that things like sight distance and being able to see over hills and that falls within the parameters. If you design for 70, generally speaking, you'll have much gentler curves. Okay, and you might not have as much vertical alignment changes, or you'll do those changes over a greater period of time, so you're not interrupting the motorist's ability to see and react to a condition that might be over the hill or around the curve. That's a very simplistic view of it, but Paul, did you want to expand?
You're right, John. Everything you said is accurate. It's a maximum speed limit that's determined up front, and it reflects how the factors that we're going to use that are going to be built into the road, the geometric factors that we're going to use to build into the road so that we know it'll operate adequately for that speed limit.
The Tri-State was originally designed for 60. That's depicted in the light color and the red. Those segments of the system were designed for 70.
Chair, I just had a couple quick questions. The first, Mr. Donner, the document that talked about the software from the U.S. The limits.
U.S. limits too.
I'm just curious, how do you all factor that document into your analysis?
Prior to IDOT coming up with their new methodology that they adopted by policy in January 2014, we actually used U.S. limits too. And the old IDOT formula or methodology, if you will, when we did some of our initial speed limit studies. What we found was that U.S. Limits 2, and maybe you ought to speak to U.S. Limits 2, but we weren't satisfied that U.S. Limits 2 provided an objective criteria that allowed us to accurately factor in other things beyond prevailing speed. There were statements in there, but the IDOT policy, what's nice about that is the first two portions of that process are very objective. And if certain criteria are met, then you make this adjustment. U.S. Limits 2 leaves it much, I think, more open for engineering judgment and interpretation. And I think U.S. Limits 2, again, is a policy that applies to all highways, whereas IDOT's methodology does zero in on interstates.
If I could add to that, a couple things. Not a single state that we found embraces and uses U.S. Limits 2 as their speed limit setting methodology. The federal government does not promote it as a standard. They promote it as a tool and a check, a tool for municipalities that cannot or do not have access to an expert and a check for experts, which is exactly how we used it in the original studies. Also, if you go to the U.S. Limits 2 website, you can follow the logic and methodology. As John alluded to about not taking factors into consideration, that there is some complex logic in there, but essentially it'll boil down to either the 85th or the 50th percentile is the speed that it's recommending. So it's not considering a lot of crash. Crash is an input, but it's really deciding whether you're taking the 85th or the 50th percentile. So it's more simplistic than a complex situation like this really demands.
So, and I would say U.S. Limits 2, it's a computer program. So, it is utilized by a lot of jurisdictions or agencies that don't have access to a traffic engineering expert. So, the downfall or a potential negative of just following U.S. Limits 2 is that you don't apply any critical thinking to it, you know, after you get the results. So, that's what you have to safeguard against.
Very good. Thank you.
Next steps, if I can just finish this and then we'll resume questions. We're looking for the board to act on our recommendation today. The TOEI then will have to send a recommendation to IDOT for their concurrence, and we'll also send a submittal to the Committee on Administrative Rules, the Joint Committee, JCAR. Once JCAR rules and once IDOT concurs or doesn't concur, TOEI will then submit the rule to the Secretary of State for publication, and then we will have direction to go ahead and change the limits in the system, which we anticipate. If all that happens quickly, assuming that the board approves our recommendation, then we would be changing the limits sometime in early to midsummer. So with that, if there are other questions or comments or...
Just one more.
Yes.
So after that process happens, and you post in the limits, what would trigger a review at some point of, I mean, once they're set, is there a process for?
Yeah, our practice, which again was set by the Traffic Operations Safety Committee, is to go back and do a one-year post-analysis of whether our adjustments were successful or not. We've already done that for the extension of South 355, where we made the increase to 65. We did a one-year review and assessment of that, and we're actually very pleased that speed limit appears to have been a good judgment on our part, a good increase on our part. Average speeds have only increased by 2 miles in that section. Crash rates have not gone up, and it seems to be performing just fine. So we will, we're actually going to this year go and take a look back at the 70 mile an hour rural segments to see how they've fared. particularly the area north up toward Rockford. We've got greater truck volume and greater traffic. And we will do that for other increases as well. As we reach the one-year anniversary of an increase, we'll go back and reevaluate and study it.
Thank you.
Other questions? I had one question. If I understood you correctly, what you said is that one of the factors that might determine what we do is what the interstates that we connect to have set as their speed limits, so 55 and 80?
Yes.
As the Illinois law has changed, are those speed limits being reviewed, and are they likely to change?
Yeah, IDOT certainly has the responsibility to review their roads and determine the speed limits on their roads. My understanding is that IDOT plans on maintaining 65 miles an hour on Interstate 80 because of some operational issues involved in Joliet and then further east once you get toward Indiana. And it's important to note that where 80 and 294 come together, that remains at 55 miles an hour, and IDOT has not suggested that we look at changing that. So there are numerous factors that cause that to occur. In the methodology, that's the third step. That's where the engineers would review and see what makes sense.
And I guess I was only asking because that's a variable that could change, but I think what you're saying, and that it's IDOT's responsibility, and then we would review it. But what you're saying now is your understanding is that they're going to keep it at the level that it was. So
that
we have shared responsibilities here, right?
Yeah,
right.
And we've reached out to IDOT. We've talked to them. We aren't aware of any changes that they're making. Of course, when we provide them with our traffic, you know, study, they're going to have another opportunity to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're changing or something.
Okay.
I mean, our changes make sense in light of what these speed limits are going to be on the interstate systems that we connect with.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And again, I just have to commend our team on some very hard work. I know John, you and your team, CDM Smith, Paul, have all done the lion's share of the work to get us to this point, so thank you very much for that. Now, on to the next presentation on the agenda is from Diversity and Strategic Planning, and we actually hope to have more than just a presentation, but a real discussion on what's being presented. As maybe the board recalls, back in 2011, we created the Department of Diversity and Strategic Development as a direct report to the executive director. So there had always been a diversity function and a goal-setting function at the tollway, but it was housed within either engineering or procurement, and we elevated it and made it a standalone department with a direct report to the executive director because we had heard so clearly from the board the importance of diversity for everything that the tollway does. The department has primarily focused on contracting diversity, although certainly other diversity efforts. And we heard loud and clear a couple of months ago as the board continued to ask questions about the tollway's diversity efforts that we wanted to see what kind of the next generation of our initiatives could be. So we thought we'd take an opportunity to, you know, spend the first part of the presentation updating you and making sure everybody's aware of what we've done thus far in just the first couple of years of having the department in place. And then Gustavo Giraldo, who's been heading that unit up for us, is going to go into some ideas that we have that we hope to have some discussion on for maybe enhancing the tollways diversity efforts, particularly given, you know, what we continue to hear from the board on an ongoing basis is, you know, wanting to make sure that we are doing everything that we can to provide opportunities for all types of businesses to take advantage of, particularly our tremendous Move Illinois program, but really all opportunities that exist at the tollway. So in the past 4 years, I think we've more effectively reached out to firms and have done a great deal of work, and we'll go into that, but there's certainly more to do. So I'll just ask Gustavo to come up. And I think that this presentation is meant to be informal. So we hope that you feel comfortable, and I know you will, interrupting and asking questions and really engaging in a discussion I think that what we would envision is the discussion leads to an actual development of a policy that then, per standard set in some of our committees, would be posted publicly and we could get the public comment on. As you heard from some folks here today, we have previewed it with a couple of organizations just to make sure we're on the right track. But I'm sure that there'll be more refining that happens as a result of the board discussion. So, Gustavo?
Thank you, Christy, for that very smart introduction and framing the issue so well. Thank you also to the board of directors for listening today to this presentation. And I'm sure in a little bit over 3 years that I've been working for the Thoughtway, I've never known this board to be shy at all to express its opinions about a multiple issues, including diversity. And I know that all of you are incredibly passionate about this issue. One of the reasons I keep working for the Thoughtway and very proud and giving it all my 100% or maybe sometimes 150 and 200 is because I know I have your backs. And that to me counts a lot. Christie's and the board of directors, everywhere I go, I just say, well, you know, I am the most fortunate chief of diversity that you can ever find, because I really do have the total endorsement, the total understanding of the top leadership of the agency, and that to me really makes a humongous difference in the type of work I do and the accomplishments that we have so far achieved and we hope to achieve in the years to come. So with that said, let's just get a little bit of it. Today's presentation will begin with a brief overview of the history of the diversity and strategic development initiatives in the department. I will then discuss some of the issues that are barriers to participate for small and diverse firms, what actions the Thoughtway has taken to reduce those barriers, and what still needs to be done to encourage greater participation for firms of all sizes and types. I hope that we can engage in some meaningful discussion and the next steps, and we would like to take, that we would like to take to address the gaps that remain. The Diversity and Strategic Development Department was created in 2012 with the mission to increase access to economic opportunities for disadvantaged, minority, and women-owned business enterprises, as well as underemployed individuals. The statistics on this slide provide a snapshot of the level of DMWB participation over the past several years. From January 1, 2009 to December 31, 2014, the Thoughtway has paid $3.1 billion on construction and professional service contracts, including more than $2.3 billion on construction contracts and $801 million on professional service contracts. Of that total, 20.1% or $456.8 million went to DMWBE business and construction contracts, while 32.7% or $262.3 million went to DMWB businesses and professional service contracts. Taken together, the Thoughtway has paid $719 million or 23.4% of all money paid for construction and professional services to these kinds of businesses. So while the majority of contracts are awarded to non-minority firms, the Thoughtway does have a history of including DM and WB businesses in construction and professional service work. The level of participation on professional service contracts is strong, and we will continue to develop initiatives to push that total even higher. Therefore, today's presentation will concentrate on increasing DBE, MBE, WB participation on construction contracts. After the department was created in 2012, we began meeting with key stakeholder groups and advocacy agencies to hear their concerns and gather input on how best to increase participation by small and diverse firms on Thoughtway construction projects. We also hosted networking events and outreach sessions for construction and professional services in order to proactively raise awareness of upcoming opportunities. The Thoughtway also administered a small contractor survey to collect feedback and gauge the interest level in working on Thoughtway projects. Finally, the Thoughtway evaluated its own practices and history of involving DMWB firms on capital projects. While professional service contracts were shown to have a strong track record in achieving DBE goals, there was opportunity to improve DBE participation on construction contracts. Through these efforts, the tollway was able to develop targeted programs that, taken together, create a pipeline for improving diversity and helping businesses prepare to become prime contractors on tollway contracts and increasing the number of contracting opportunities. The feedback we received defined what small and diverse contractors identified as their level of interest and potential barriers to participation as primes or subs on tollway work. What we have learned includes, first, small contracts, those under $5 million, are a must. But even smaller contracts, those around $1 million, are desired by small and diverse firms. Second, the tollway should continue to offer subcontracting opportunities. Third, many small and diverse construction firms need help to pursue tollway opportunities as primes or subs. And fourth, the tollway needs to increase communication and outreach about upcoming opportunities. The next few slides will review our actions to address these issues in order to increase participation. First, contractor told us to continue offering small contracting opportunities. In response, the tollway worked hard to identify opportunities to increase the number of small contracts for construction whenever practical. For example, we unbundled some larger jobs into a range of contract sizes and types that we believe will be of interest to small and diverse firms to bid as primes or participate as subs. We also made efforts to assemble bid packages where we knew there was capacity for small and diverse firms to do the work. Our efforts have achieved positive results thus far. Under the CRP program, the tollway awarded an average of nearly 17 unbundled contracts per year. Since the start of Move Illinois, the tollway has awarded an average of 27 combined small and unbundled contracts per year. Just as encouraging, we are seeing an influx of new bidders competing for those small tollway contracts. From 2012 to 2014, 89 unique companies submitted bids on 81 small or unbundled contracts under $5 million. Of the 89 unique bidders, nearly 40%, around 35, have never bid on tollway work before as primes. 15 of the 89 were awarded prime contracts for the first time on tollway work under $5 million. Five of those firms were MBEWBs and or better. Next, the tollway small contractor survey revealed some business preferred contracts smaller than the $5 million unbundled threshold. As a result, the tollway launched a small business initiative which sets aside construction contracts generally valued at around $1 million, awarded only to registered small businesses. The tollway identified a number of contracts for this program and launched mass outreach campaigns and conducted training sessions, which I will talk about in more detail a little bit later in a couple of slides. This program has yielded promising results early on. The tollway has awarded a total of 12 small business set-aside contracts worth more than $8.3 million, including two contracts on today's consent agenda. Nearly half of the awarded set-aside contracts went to certified DMWB or veteran-owned firms. Based on the early success of this program, the tollway continues to review the types of opportunities that will best fit the criteria for small business set-aside contracts, guided by factors including safety, efficient delivery and administration of the projects, scope and nature of the work, and commodity code eligibility. Thus far in 2015, the tollway has awarded more set-aside contracts compared with previous years, and is also considering setting small business goals on larger contracts.
So I think we could say in this, just in terms of a trend, I think what we've observed is, you know, particularly on the unbundling effort, I know that in the beginning, even the first couple of projects, what I noticed is we didn't necessarily have bidders from either the small contracting community or the DMWBE community. But as time went on, we started to see, and this is, I think, why we included on the previous slides the bidder information, because I do think that's important, more firms coming to the table to bid that were kind of new to tollway projects, even as primes. Maybe new to tollway projects, period, but certainly new as prime bidders. And that trend is something that, you know, I think is important for us to capture. And as those firms see the opportunities continue to be available, you know, hopefully they'll be more willing to take advantage of bidding opportunities. So I think that, you know, we would see these as a good first step or initial movement, and I know engineering's been very supportive. You know, I don't know, at some point there might be a conversation around what we would like the outcomes to be, but I do think that it's important to not only look at who's necessarily being awarded the contracts or winning, but also this pool of kind of shotgun goal, right? Because ultimately shotgun goal hopefully translate into
goals.
I like that.
Yes, thank you. I knew you would.
We also learned through our early outreach efforts and bid results that small and diverse construction firms, including first-time bidders and tollway work, were not prepared to take advantage of contract opportunities. With input from stakeholders and advocacy agencies, the department forged strategic partnerships in order to develop and provide technical assistance to these companies. The tollway is currently involved with three assistance programs: the Construction Business Development Center, or CBDC, which was established in partnership with the Illinois Community College Board. The Construction Business Development Center provides small minority and women-owned construction businesses with the customized training and technical assistance needed to bid tollway contracts under $5 million. To date, 57 firms have been assisted, and nearly 40% of those firms went on to submit bids on tollway work. The Construction Coaching for Growth Program, or CC4G, was launched in partnership with the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity and the Illinois Hispanic Chamber of Commerce to provide structured 3-month course-based training programs to firms specializing in heavy highway construction. And finally, the Small Contractor Bridge Program was launched in partnership with the Illinois Finance Authority and the Chicago Community Loan Fund to provide access to bonding and capital loans to small contractors. To date, 133 contractors are in the application process, and 4 performance and bid bonds have been issued on tollway projects. The tollway also increased outreach efforts to alert small and diverse contractors about upcoming bid opportunities and the available resources in place to help them participate on tollway projects and ultimately grow their businesses. These outreach efforts include hosting or co-hosting construction networking events that provide overviews of upcoming bid opportunities, placing thousands of phone calls and dozens of targeted emails to alert small and diverse contractors of contract opportunities, conducting Are You Ready to Bid sessions to provide customized orientations for projects that are out for bid, hosting a free training webinar for contractors who wanted or who want to learn how to do business with the tollway, and providing the tollway's look-ahead schedule for upcoming bid opportunities. We will continue to diligently perform these outreach efforts. So, despite the many gains that tollway has made in increasing access to opportunities for small and diverse firms, gaps remain. These gaps include small and DMWB contractors need additional hands-on tailor assistance over a long duration. The tollway needs additional bidders from existing pool of small and DBE firms. Many DBE firms remain underutilized, and new businesses may benefit from meaningful instruction from more experienced peers in the industry. With input from the industry stakeholders and others, the tollway has crafted a number of new approaches to address these gaps, several of which will be implemented in 2015. To provide technical assistance to small and diverse firms, the tollway has recently issued a request for proposals, or RFP, to enhance the existing Construction Business Development Center and Coaching for Growth programs. The RFP will solicit proposals from technical assistance providers on how they will provide in-depth, long-term technical assistance over years to small, diverse, and veteran contractors, The goal is to provide intensive, in-depth technical assistance intervention in all areas of business development required to become effective heavy highway construction contractors.
Should I cite examples?
Examples of these hands-on assistance include facilitating access to capital and guidance in financing and bonding assistance options, IDOT pre-qualification submittal assistance for specialty firms, accounting systems assistance, including certified payroll reports, change orders, and project closeout, and proactive community government relations and construction industry outreach.
So you may recall when we and brought the board the original, these first partnerships for the technical assistance program, we did say that we were going to have kind of the next phase of it as a competitive RFP. And I think that we've, you know, structured something here that from our experience over the course of the last year or so targets in on where, I mean, we feel the gap is. So the proposals haven't come in yet, so certainly if there's some different thinking, we can always create an addendum or change something, right? I don't think we've received
proposals yet. It was just
put out, but we thought it was important given the fact that we are moving into not only this year, but you know, next year will be another big year of construction, and it goes on and on, to get something going on the technical assistance side. So
do we have any sense of what the field is? Are there a lot of companies that do provide this that have track records that we can actually measure? Or maybe companies, that's the wrong term, entities. So some may be companies, some may be
there are firms that do these for a living, but obviously, you know.
I think that what you'd probably end up seeing is, you know, because there are so many different components, you know, it might be a combination of resources, right? So a proposal wouldn't necessarily just be one entity. Maybe it would be led by an entity, but they would maybe bring, you know, other technical professional resources to the table.
A teaming proposal. That's what we probably would expect to see, given the range of services we expect the engaged service delivery contractors to provide. So it may be, say, for example, a combination of a advocacy agency with some level of expertise from an outside engineering consultant, maybe some legal firm also may be involved in some of the legal matters that are involving heavy highway construction. So I foresee some of those coming through now. We'll have to see what actually is proposed. But there are also firms that are specialized in providing this type of technical assistance all by themselves. And there's a handful of them, I don't know, about 10, 12.
And when we evaluate, or when you evaluate them, you are able to see data about their effectiveness?
Yes, we are asking for that, absolutely. We're asking for track record.
And when they talk about their track record, since we see successes in certain groups and less successes in other groups, are they able to document that? I'm trying to walk around the issue that our general counsel may have about how do we define how we reach out to particular groups. Maybe there's no answer to that.
That's an important question. We have to ascertain through the evaluation process that we're selecting the right mix of service providers so that the gaps that exist are truly being addressed by capacity. So it is an issue of not only the ability to provide the services, but are they really able to reach out those groups that are really in most need of the assistance? Obviously, that's got to be part. It is going to be part of our evaluation process.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so essentially, vendors really need in their proposals to demonstrate similar experience to what we're seeking through this RFP.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The tollway needs additional bidders to participate in tollway contracts. To this end, the tollway is working to identify ways of addressing pre-qualification requirements that potentially limit small and diverse firms from competing on tollway contracts. These methods involve developing project-specific requirements and off-Broadway work valued at $5 million or less in lieu of the financial pre-qualification statements issued by IDOT. Possible options include considering bonding capacity in lieu of the IDOT pre-qualification and will be applied on contracts involving various trades such as fencing, maintenance facility site work, landscaping, and demolition work.
Gustav, besides the bonding, now are the minority firms that are working as subcontractors, are they also required to be all union companies?
Yes, to my knowledge, everyone has to be on the PLA.
And have we ever looked at how many non-union companies are qualified to do it? Is there a market out there as well?
I don't have data on how many of those firms are non-union. I do know from our constant engagement with our technical service providers, which is probably one of the best sources, as well as advocacy agencies that are our strategic partners, that periodically there are firms that come to them saying, I'm not a union shop. I have no means to get that, you know, to be able to get to that point where I'm going to be a union shop because of all the requirements and all the financing that's behind that. And obviously, because we are subject to the PLA, it's not that we would not be able to provide them the service. We're happy to provide them the service, but we can't expect them. We're not going to tell them, well, you're going to be able to do work on tollway projects without this issue being addressed. So that always becomes a little bit of a difficult question to address for companies that come to us. Not that many that come to us, but they do come, and I do hear about it periodically, several times a year.
Could you flip back to the last slide,
please?
Because Christy talked about having an informal discussion.
Yeah.
I'd like to sort of
pause
on this slide and ask sort of what are the pros and cons of doing this?
Well, let's talk about first what that IDOT pre-qual means, and maybe, Paul, you're the best position to do that. But, you know, and just kind of a little bit about the pre-qualification process, because we do use IDOT's pre-qualification. It probably is worth a little bit of a description of that, and then why we think that this is an issue potentially on these smaller jobs and why we might be comfortable loosening this requirement. But why don't we start with pre-quals?
So, first of all, the pre-qual for to be a subcontractor is very, very easy. All they have to do is register, so that's not an issue. To be a prime, though, however, they do have to provide information, especially audited financials for like the past 5 years to IDOT, so that they can make a determination on whether this company is, you know, financially stable enough to take on work of a certain value. So they issue a certification letter on the financial capacity, and then they also evaluate the type of work that they do to determine if, you know, they could be a general in that specific role on that type of work. The process, it does take a little while. We've had one of our DB contractors go through and get their financial availability rating updated recently, and that took a few weeks. If you have the information, you could do it. It is a barrier, there's no doubt, especially to new firms. So the question is, you know, whether or not we need to have that protection. And I feel pretty strongly that if we're talking about work on the roadway itself, where I'm putting workers in harm's way and also the motoring public is potentially impacted, I feel like I have a system which relies on the IDOT pre-qual that I've never had any issues with, so I'm hesitant to move off of that. Now, if we're talking about facilities work or work off the mainline roadway, I think there's room, and then we've already exercised judgment on some of those projects. Facilities contracts, there isn't really IDOT pre-quals for vertical work. You know, they focus primarily on the horizontal transportation roadway type work going on. So we have been utilizing CDB guidelines and qualifications or the architectural standard guidelines, you know, to provide us with some level of comfort that the people who are bidding on that type of work actually know what they're getting into. And then, you know, with respect to the financial capacity, I mean, I don't want to go through the efforts of re-advertising jobs or defaulting contractors and finding new contractors to come on board to finish the work or calling in bonds on contractors. I mean, that's the last thing we have time for. And also, it hurts everyone in the process. But, you know, I think there is a, I think I would have comfort in knowing that, you know, maybe if we could specify, I mean, they do have to get a bid bond to work on our jobs. And that's the trust and venture, I believe, requires them to have, for us to have bonds on everybody doing our work. So we do require them to get a bid bond. I think that it's logical that if the bid bonding company is giving them a bid bond for the value of work that they're proposing on, that they'll probably follow through and give them a performance bond once they are the successful bidder. So we were going to look at the possibility of maybe saying, you know, as long as you can